You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Thanks so much, everyone, for joining us for this debate on the relationship between growth and inequality in London. Really critical topic, I'm sure you'll all agree. It's a great pleasure to welcome you all here tonight. So we're here to explore the relationship between growth and inequality in London. And I've been a Londoner all my life, and it's always struck me, I suppose, that London's a city of contradictions. So it's by far the wealthiest part of the country, but we're also part of the country that is higher than average levels of poverty. We're home to some of the most expensive real estate in the country, but we also have a higher proportion than average of renters and people who are locked out of the housing market. We have the best teaching hospitals in the country, but some of the most profound health inequalities. And I think it's perfectly possible for Londoners of different means to live completely separate lives. And so I think what we're really here to debate today is there a relationship between growth and inequality? Does it matter? And if so, what should we do about it? And tonight's debate is co-hosted by the RSA, whose lovely room we are in, and the Trust for London. And this is part of the Trust for London's 125th anniversary celebrations. And we'll be hearing a bit about that shortly. So we've got a fantastic panel for you this evening. First of all, I realise I forgot to introduce myself. My name's Sonia Soder. I'm Chief Leader Writer at The Observer, and I'm also very honoured to be a trustee of the Trust for London. Our panel tonight, we have Professor Danny Dorling on my far right, who's a Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford. I'm sure he'll be known to many of you for his work on inequality. We have Linda Grattan on my immediate right. She's a Professor of Management Practice at the London Business School. Faiza Sheehan, who's the Director of the Centre for Labour and Social Studies. And on my far left, Mark Littlewood, who's Director General of the Institute for Economic Affairs. So great panel for you tonight. Before we kick off, though, I would just like to invite the Chief Executive of the Trust for London, Bharat Mehta, who's just going to say a few words.
Thanks very much, Sonia, for that. Thank you, all of you, for attending this event. I know it's a lovely evening outside, but you're not going to be missing it for what you're about to hear from this amazing, thought-provoking panel that we've got. It's our 125th anniversary. It happens to actually be today, the 12th of April, that we had our first board meeting chaired by the then Lord Mayor of London at Mansion House. Trust for London is a grant-making body, and we fund mainly voluntary organisations working to tackle poverty and inequality in London. We also fund research, and we use our own resources to tackle poverty and inequality and to raise the whole debate around equality in London. And today's event is the first of our series of events right through the year that we'll be having in raising this debate. And how timely is it? We couldn't have timed it better if we had tried, really. It's the hot topic at the moment. So I very much look forward to hearing what the panelists have to say with the debate that we're going to have. Thank you very much indeed, Sonia.
Thanks. Great. So without further ado, Danny, over to you.
London is a wonderful city. Anyone can make it if they try hard enough. All of London's children have access to equally well-resourced schools. When people gain jobs, they are reasonably paid. The rents are fair, and the quality of housing in London is high. Healthcare is amongst the best funded in Europe, thanks to taxation of the City of London. Transport in London works well and is affordable. You can safely cycle around this city. People are not overworked. Career progression is always possible. The police treat all Londoners equally and are well respected everywhere. Londoners' elderly enjoy a good standard of living, even those without savings. There are hardly any homeless people in London. Prostitution is rare. The best off in society respect others' rights and know their own responsibilities and don't take more than their fair share. London produces goods and services of such great value to the rest of the world that it more than pays its way in the world. It offers reasonably priced higher education to people in the world and inside England, and cheap train travel to escape the city if you want to go to the countryside. All these claims are untrue. Schooling in London is the most divided within Europe. This is one thing which in polite society we don't talk about. It is always interesting to watch commentators on the BBC pretend their children go to state schools, but they don't. We have an apartheid in our schooling system in London. Income inequalities in this country are the highest that they are in Europe. The best off 10% take 28% of all income. Half of that is taken by just the best off 1%. London leads that, but it isn't because London is special. This is a very, very unequal country. The country, and London in particular, thrives and keeps on going because people come here with hope. And in particular, they come to London with hope of a better life. They come with their qualifications that they've earned elsewhere in Europe and other places. They come willing to work very hard, and they come hoping to build a good life, and most of them fail to do that. London loses almost as many people as come in, but it is growing. A few people cash in, most don't. London is not easy to understand. It is not easy to know why we are living in the most unequal city of the large cities of the rich world. It is not easy to understand why London has become so unequal at the moment. This was the city of empire, and I think this matters. This was the largest city on the world just 100 years ago. This is the city that is having to adjust to no longer receiving the tribute that it got from empire, which this city never really understood was its main income for so very long. This city told itself that it was working hard and it was producing the goods that made it so rich, despite the fact that half the world was coloured pink. In the 1970s and 1980s, when London was much more equal, when the country was much more equal, people who saw their advantage from empire reduce became very angry, and they funded think tanks and other organisations to tell you that this was all wrong, that you should accept growing inequality, that it was good, that it was fine if we have a high level of inequality because it rewards success and it penalises failure. We have had a 40-year experiment in what happens if you do this. They tell you that there is no alternative. This is how the rest of the world works. They do not want you, though, to look at the rest of the world, to look at how children are schooled elsewhere in Europe, to look at what the average incomes of average families are in other countries, which are higher, to look at the cost of public transport, which is lower, to look at people's ability to start and raise a family, to look at how much less rents are in all those places which have rent regulations. They don't want you to know that it is possible to live a very different life than the life that we are currently living in London. I think this is coming to an end. I think the Panama Papers will show this coming to an end because they reveal what many of us always knew and suspected, but what we're now going to get dripping out week after week after week, because so many hundred journalists do not spend so long on so many papers and not produce hundreds of thousands of news stories that are to come. London has a choice over where it's going to go. Does London want to become the plaything for billionaires of the world? Does London want to have a government whose aim is to increase house prices in London to the highest they can get to, because the government sees high house prices as a sign of success? And if you cannot afford to live in this city, it means you're not good enough. I think we're at a turning point. I think it's become so extreme that I think it's understandable why the anger has risen about this. And all people are asking for is to have what people in other cities in Europe already have, which is a degree of respect for each other which is decent, which we lost some time ago. Thank you.
Thanks, Danny. Lots of food for thought there, and lots on what we would all like London to look like, I think, at the start of your talk. Linda.
Well, thank you so much, Danny. And actually, your beginnings of the conversation about what London might be reminded me that, of course, this is also the year of the celebration of the writing of Utopia. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's also good to remind ourselves of that. I don't study London, so I need to say that straight away, and I know that Danny has done an extraordinary amount of work understanding what's happening to London. I study countries and organisations, and in particular, I look at future trends. And so I'm going to share with you two observations today. One is, what are we learning from future trends which are shaping all advanced economies, but of course will have a significant impact on London? And then secondly, because I study corporations, I wanted to make some remarks about the role that corporations could play to make London the sort of place that Danny has described, and I know that we would want all our children to live in. Let me begin by talking about the six trends, global trends. These are not UK trends, these are global trends, which, if unchecked, will increase inequality in London and many other cities of the world. The first one is what economists have called the hollowing out of work. And that's a simply described phenomena that if you look at all jobs, from the most skilled to the least skilled, the middle jobs are disappearing. They're disappearing because of robotics, artificial intelligence, machine learning. Well, why does that impact on inequality? Well, the impact there is that the lower skilled jobs generally in advanced economies get paid, people doing those jobs get paid less, and people doing the highly skilled work, often selling their skills into a global market pace, get paid more. And so we are seeing a divergence in terms of the economy of advanced countries of the world, ours included. The second is that what's very clear to me, and I write quite a lot about the future of work, is that the future, for those of you and your children who want to sell their skills into a labour market, the future is about highly specialised skills. And again, this is just going to push inequality because highly specialised skills tend to be associated with high levels of education and indeed access to networks that allow people to, you know, to develop those skills. The third is what sociologists call assortative mating. And that's a sort of a marvellous way of describing that people who are similar to each other now marry each other and now have children who are similar to them. And I see it, frankly, at London Business School. We have a large a population of students from around the world. Only 12-15% of our students are from the UK, but nevertheless, what's very clear is that my MBA students are mating, marrying, and having children with each other. And of course, by doing so, they're just moving themselves further away from the sort of average person. The next trend that will increase inequality is the work of that myself and my co-author, Andrew Scott, have written in a book which will be published next month called The 100-Year Life. And what's very clear there is that the 100 years, which is a huge, we think, gift for people, is really only available to educated, healthy people. And in fact, anybody who's not educated and who's not healthy will not live anything like 100 years. And that's why right now the life expectancy in an inner city in Glasgow is equivalent to the life expectancy of some Indian cities. So there's another source of inequality. Let me just finish with a few others. Obviously, the reduction in volunteering, which means that the different types of people aren't mixing together in volunteer work as they did before. And again, that has gone down unbelievably fast. I mean, for those of you who following the sociology of that, it's very, very clear. Increased in cross-generational differences. You know, we now are seeing four generations together. They have different experiences. The differences between them are going to get greater, particularly financially. And also, let's remind ourselves in terms of increasing inequality, is that for those who have highly specialist skills and who earn quite a lot of money, the inequality is that they are working longer. So, you know, maybe 50 years ago, when the idea was that those people with low skill, low pay, worked the longest hours, that's not the case in London. Right now in London, the higher skilled are working a great deal longer in terms of hours than the low skills. And there's a whole set of reasons why, but nevertheless, we see that as an important trend. Okay, these are the trends that are increasing inequality. What's on the horizon that I could see now to say, well, what would decrease inequality? And let me make a couple of statements there. The first is the promise of online education. Now, of course, Danny's right to point out that London has incredible inequality with regard to education. However, there is a growing body of evidence that actually people from any walk of life could potentially have access to this extraordinary amount of data and information and knowledge that's now being made freely available. Second is, however you feel about Uber, the fact is that platforms like Uber are going to provide opportunities to people who didn't have those opportunities. And we can also see opportunities for one of the positives about the 100-year life is, of course, the longer you live, the further you move away from where you started. And that, we think, is also potentially a source of the decrease of inequality. Now, what more is there to say that I can say? Well, the second thing I just wanted to say generally is, of course, when we look at the reduction of inequality, there are multiple stakeholders here, educators, corporations, civil society, unions, the government with fiscal policy and so on. I want to just focus in my last minute on one, which is corporations. Now, what role can corporations play in inequality? Well, we know that they've played quite a significant role in increasing inequality, but let me make a couple of points about that. The first is, a corporation can make a difference by the way it treats its people inside the corporation. So we have in the UK and in London one of the great poster childs of the way that employees are treated in John Lewis, which is held up right across the world, by the way, if you're not aware of that, as one of the great corporations in terms of the way it distributes its wealth. By the way, it's pretty hard. I can give you a long list. I wrote a book about this, about what corporations are doing. Very few of them are based in London. I could only really think of John Lewis. And that's in part because London is full, as you know, of professional service firms and banks, and neither of those have any great history in terms of reducing inequality. Those corporations that do, and we have to often look outside of the UK into Europe to understand that, do that in three ways. Firstly, they use their stakeholder alliance capability to build alliances across multiple corporations. Secondly, they use their scaling and mobilizing capability. You see that right across Africa now with some of the food companies in terms of how they're scaling and mobilizing to bring low-cost food to people around Africa. And thirdly is they use their R&D capability. So right now in India, for example, a coalition of Indian IT multinationals is educating millions of Indian children. So let me finish by saying I think that we know that London is becoming the major creative cluster in the world, the major cluster in the world for creative industries. Their data is now becoming very clear on that. I think there's a great opportunity for us to build a society that's more equal. However, I think corporations have got to play a much more active role in that.
Thanks very much, Linda. I'm sure I'm not the only person who's been a bit disappointed by the reaction of some corporations to the higher national minimum wage. We've heard about lots of companies taking away benefits rather than thinking about employee benefits, rather than thinking about productivity, but maybe that's something we can return to in the debate. Pfizer, do you think inequality in London matters?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I think it matters. Having grown up here myself, in the East End of London, and I've seen it play out over my lifetime, and worried about the levels it's at right now, to be honest. What I want to use the next few minutes for, though, is to really think about this relationship between economic growth and inequality, and I think both rear a very ugly head in London, and I find it hard to be rude about London, as I'm so precious about the city I was born in. I was slightly perturbed, I think, when I saw the questions that were sent to me on this debate. So let me repeat them. Is growing inequality a price worth paying for London's continued economic success? And in another email, I got a question saying, can the capital continue to foster economic efficiency in the face of the current scale of inequality? Now, this is a very common framing of the relationship between economic growth and inequality. So we can't have one without the other. You've got to have inequality and growth. You can't have, for those of you that like graphs and stats, there's a positive correlation. So the more you have inequality, the more you have growth. That is wrong. That is just not the relationship. And it's not only wrong, it's quite dangerous. I think it's quite misleading in a way, because it kind of sets out that there's no alternative, that we have to pick one or the other, that greater equality and growth are somehow enemies. And actually, taking a step back, it assumes that we already have a kind of good, sustainable type of growth. And I really want to sort of delve into that a bit and think about what that means for policy going forward. So in terms of being wrong, I think obviously, obviously some inequality is good for incentives, etc. But we are beyond that level. And the OECD recently found that in a study about growth, that in the last two decades, the UK would have had growth at a level at about 6-9% higher if inequality, income and disparities hadn't widened. And that's mainly, their work looks at mainly kind of the loss of talent and skills in the economy because of that inequality. And not only that, the paper found that if you have more kind of redistributive policies, so cash transfers, higher quality education, training, if you invest in those things, actually that doesn't harm growth. That's good for growth. So from that very kind of simple perspective of, you know, do you have to have inequality to have growth? I think recent studies, and OECD is not a kind of left-leaning think tank, and the IMF and others are starting to say very similar things, that levels of inequality now are bad for growth. I think we also need to think about, beyond that kind of very simple relationship, about the type of economic success that we have in London today. Inequality in London, so it's a very close relationship between the two, and in a way, London's growth is predicated on inequality. And it's an experiment which shows that not only would London potentially have more growth if we had lower inequality, having grown up in a school or having gone to a school where only kind of barely a third would leave with 5 A to Cs. I saw that lost talent, and for sure, like, we could have had, if I think about the people I went to school with who were very smart but just didn't have the opportunity. It's not just that. It's also that we could have better, stronger, more sustainable growth if we did something about inequality. Let me just take something like efficiency. So in a very kind of strict economic term, what does that mean? It means, it implies that we're in an economic state in which every resource is optimally allocated to serve each person in the best way while minimizing waste and inefficiency. I don't want to start listing the same list as Danny. I mean, I've got like the opposite list. But what evidence supports this? I mean, can we really say we're efficient when nearly one in five London households end up in the red on a monthly basis just from buying essentials? Can we really say that we're efficient and that we have good growth when we know that so much, a lot of what's happening in terms of tax evasion and a very topical issue about tax havens right now, that that goes through London. Our accountants in London are too often the accountants of the global elite hiding money that could be used for schools and healthcare and roads. And let's not also forget that this very same city, financial sector, brought the economy to its knees in 2008. Can we say we're efficient when we have an average house price in London, which is now £500,000, at the same time median income is about 39,000. So I could go on. I mean, there's a very long list of things. There are our contracts. I mean, the amount of money that is going to the 1% versus everyone else. I don't think we can say that we have economic efficiency. And the type of growth we have, when I was thinking about this today, reminds me of that JFK beautiful speech that he did on gross national product and GDP, where he said, our gross national product counts air pollution and cigarette advertising and ambulances to clear out highways of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and the jails for the people who break them. And for me, unfortunately, London's growth right now counts immoral tax evasion, people's debt misery, and asthma rates. I mean, the number of lives lost now in the city because of pollution is growing, and it's worrying. It's in the thousands. Look, for me, London's inequality is a clear indicator that the economic system is not working. I think that we need to be asking always what kind of society that we want to live in, and that's a very important question to how much inequality we want to see. But we also need to consider whether we're happy with an economy that is predicated on a rat race, on a growing divide between winners and losers, and what that means for policy going forward. And this is a criticism, I think, today in some of the ways that we've been dealing with some of the issues in the city in terms of poverty, is that we've been almost doing a kind of social policy fix. We haven't been thinking enough about the economic policy and how the economy in itself is lending itself to more inequality, what we can do about the financial system, for instance, what we can do about the city and the way it's behaving to make sure that the bank is serving us rather than the other way around. And these questions have to be critical if we are really going to tackle inequality. We cannot afford to continue to do kind of sticking plaster type policies where we just deal with, say, young people and apprenticeships, and which is a good thing. We can't just do rent controls. We have to look at the whole piece, and we have to think much more about what's happening in our economy. That it's not separate to society, and it's very much at the heart of inequality. Thanks.
Thanks, Pfizer. That was a great pitch for pre-distribution. So, Mark, inequality is holding back growth. Do you agree?
I don't agree. Blimey, what a depressing 20 minutes. You would have thought London's one of the worst places to live on planet Earth, that we would be leaving by our millions to relocate to the socialist utopia of Copenhagen or Stockholm or some boring city like that. I think it is worth saying what a fantastic city London is and how markedly it has improved over the last couple of decades. I'm not trying to belittle its problems or to suggest there are none. I've lived here for just over 20 years myself. And not just for me, I'm not measuring my life, but on any social metric pretty much you care to measure, there has been staggering improvement in the right direction. Educational standards have increased, incomes have increased, crime has gone down. It's not to say everything is perfect, but it is not as bleak, I think, as some of my fellow panellists have painted it. Should we worry about inequality at all? Well, firstly, let's challenge the accepted wisdom about the inequality landscape, because it has become accepted wisdom that inequality is vast and increasing. And just because it's accepted wisdom doesn't mean that it's right. It's not, in fact, true. For if you look at the IFS statistics, we have seen inequality declining since the financial crash. I mean, in fact, if you want to bring about more equality in London, bank crises are a great policy tool to bring that about, because they hurt everybody, but they do hurt the rich disproportionately. Those at the top, according to the IFS, saw their incomes fall by 2.5% from the crash to 2014-2015, according to the Trust for London's own poverty profile. London inequality has fallen from the start of this decade to 2013-14, the last number for which we have statistics. This was comparing the 80th percentile with the 20th percentile. You can chop and change and decide whether you want to use that metric or the Gini coefficient. You'll always be able to find some measurement to show that inequality is worsening. If you're determined to do that, inequality in the UK is overall, by the Gini coefficient measure, lower now than it was in 1990. Peaked in 1990, matter of fact. It's been on a gentle, I mean, it's more or less flatlined, but it has not accelerated away since 1990. The 80s saw a huge rise in inequality, and on the Gini coefficient, it's ticked down just a little bit. It is true, I think, and some of the Linda's comments, I think, related to this, that it is easier in today's world to become colossally and stinking rich. So it is actually feasible for more people to become multi-billionaires. And actually, if you were to look at where there has been a stark increase in the divide, it's not so much between the haves and the have-nots, it's between the haves and the have-yots. The sort of top 0.01% are leaving the remainder of the 1% further behind than they've been. But I wonder whether income equality is a sensible thing to be striving for anyway. What would you say to a policy, if I could magic one up now, that increased salaries for those towards the top end by 6% and salaries for those at the bottom by 5%. Would you oppose such a salary measure, or would you warmly embrace it? I would embrace it. That would be good for London as a whole, but it would add to increasing inequality. Or conversely, if there was a policy that saw wages at the bottom stagnate, but wages at the top fall by 5 or 10%, would you warmly embrace that policy in the interests of equality? I would not, and I want to leave you with a thought experiment just at the end. I'm not sure inequality is necessarily a cause or a necessity for economic growth. You can imagine ring-fenced particular examples where it might be. I mean, do a thought. Let's assume that there are 10 billionaires in the world who've all legitimately earned their money and are thinking of relocating to London and spending all their money here. Would we welcome them coming in? Presumably we would. That would add to inequality, but their expenditure would add to economic growth. I think that we need to concentrate on poverty, not inequality, and that is a rather different challenge. The problem for low-income earners in London, I think, isn't inequality so much. It is the cost of living, and some of the other panellists have touched on that. House prices are out of control, largely because our planning restrictions have prevented any new build to speak of compared to most other Western developed countries. So I think we should tackle the cost of living rather than worry strictly about the balance between the rich and the poor. And the thought experiment I would give you is this, and I'm not saying actually that the answer is automatic, but if you could pull a lever that would miraculously increase the productivity of everybody in London such that the bottom half would be so skilled and productive that they would earn £1 million a year, and the top half would be so skilled and productive that they would earn £1 billion a year, would you pull that lever? The gap between the bottom 50% and the top 50% would be a 1,000-to-1 ratio, but the people at the bottom would still be on £1 million a year. And I think it behoves us to turn our attention to actually solving poverty. The problem is the poverty and the poor nature of the people at the bottom of the pyramid, not affluence at the top. And I think if we focus our policy in that direction, then London will continue to thrive and grow over the next two decades as it has over the previous two. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. I dread to think of the inflation in that thought experiment that would quickly erode real incomes, I think. I sense that we might be having a bit of a debate about the statistics, but for now, I would like to open it up to all of you. Great. All right. Gentleman at the back there.
Ian Dodds. My belief is based on an article in the Harvard Business Review by Professor Michael Porter, where he said that short-term capitalism had failed and that this came about in around about 1980 when the great guru economist Milton Friedman said the only measure of company success was shareholder value. That's a short-term measure. It means that you actually end up with people at the top of the organisations paying themselves, in my view, obscene amounts of money because of the increase in shareholder value. And what we need is shared long-term stakeholder value capitalism. And my question is where you look after the interests of all of the stakeholders. And that's my question.
Thank you.
My question is, what can young people do to aid the decrease in inequality, and what role can we play?
My name is Reverend Paul Nicholson. I run a company called Taxpayers Against Poverty. By a series of historical accidents, I was born in Kensington, where the expectation of life is 88. And the historical accidents continued till I retired into Tottenham, living between two wards where the expectation of life is 71. There's a 17-year difference. And yes, indeed, we should be doing something about the bottom end, like giving them enough food to have a healthy diet. And the other thing is, in order to lock our millionaires into London, shouldn't we start actually taxing their land? They need to be sure that they won't put their land in overseas banks, and they are actually findable and we know where they live, would be a vast improvement on the present system.
Great. Thank you very much. So, Danny, first of all, I wondered if you wanted to come back on some of the statistics that Mark raised in his talk. Yeah. I'll give you a chance as well, Mark. Don't worry. And also, maybe you could address this very important point about solutions, because you raised a lot of problems in your talk.
I think tonight's part of the solution and this debate is very useful, because you do need to understand that some of the views presented on the panel are commonly held by people at the top of British society. They really believe this. It's not true that they believe in assortative mating, that they're able people marry able people and produce more able people that are even more deserving, although genetics shows you that that isn't what happens. And they believe in the kind of mathematics that Mark has given you. He's in good company. Dodgy Dave used a statistic last year. He was told
I'm not going to kick you off the panel.
You're not for that. But the Prime Minister has used this inequality is narrowing. He was told off by The Economist magazine. The Economist magazine is not a hotbed of leftism. Yes, if you ignore the best of thief of society, everybody else is more in it together. But if you include the best of fifth, in particular the best of tenth, inequalities have risen. Particularly for financiers. Let's give you one thing on that. The European Banking Authority releases statistics on the incomes of bankers because they've failed to stop them being able to do it. They released the latest statistics about 2 weeks ago. It showed the biggest ever rise in the incomes of our bankers. We now have 2,926 financiers paid over €1 million a year, 2,926. The increase wasn't just the exchange rate. They checked that. They're actually paying themselves more. The next highest number in Europe to that 2,926 is 242 in Germany. Germany manages to operate with just 242 people paid that well. In France, it's 171. In Italy, it's 153. In Spain, it's 119. These 2,926 individuals are not so supremely talented compared to you that we have to pay them this much money for what they do. They do not have anywhere to go because, as you can see from those figures, there aren't any other jobs in Europe for them. In Switzerland, the top 1% is paid half as much as our top 1%. And in Switzerland, which again is not Stockholm or Denmark or Copenhagen, the Swiss pay twice as much per head for their health care than we pay. We have a very efficient NHS, but we fund it appallingly. We fund our state schools appallingly. Why do we do this? Because if you look within the top 20% of society, you will find disproportionate numbers of people who can either afford to live in the most expensive areas where the state schools are fine, or they can opt out of the system because we're not all in it together. But this debate is very, very useful to understand why we are the most unequal country in Europe and why this is the most unequal rich city in the affluent world.
Thanks, Danny. Linda, it'd be great if you could address the point from the gentleman about what might we do to create a more sort of stakeholder, I suppose, form of capitalism. And I was also very interested in what you raised around the sharing economy, because actually a lot of the time people talk about the sharing economy as an unequalising rather than an equalising force.
Yeah. That was a question that Ian Dobbs asked. And I've been sort of reflecting on the point that you've made there. Of course, it is true that in terms of capitalism and corporations, corporations that build for the future tend to distribute their assets and their resources more equally than those that don't. So you're right, and you're right that that was something that Michael Porter has talked about. And in fact, the Aspen Institute, for those who are interested, is a marvelous group fighting for this. A long-term thinking. I don't know the answer to this, but I would be interested if anyone wants to do a PhD in it. I suspect that because of the sort of taxonomy of London corporations, who are primarily professional service firms and banks, which is one of the reasons they're all paid so much, is I suspect that stakeholder value is not part of many of the corporate rhetorics of London-based companies. And I think that's true. I suspect that is true. I talked about John Lewis, but that's just one example. But can I also just say something about your question about young people? It seems to me, as a mother of young people myself, actually, that the major focus for young people should be on education. Londoners have done so well is that some of them have put a huge emphasis on educating themselves. Now, that doesn't in any way take away from Danny's point about inequality for education, and I entirely take your point. But nevertheless, one of the most fascinating pieces of research on London right now, which has been done by Deloitte, is that London is becoming the creative industry cluster of the whole world, architects, some professional service firms and so on. And that's really what will be providing jobs for Londoners. And those are, in general, jobs that require high levels of education and high levels of specialisation. And that's what I would... that's what I would say to any young person in London. Now, you're right, we have incredibly bad access to educational opportunities. However, I believe, maybe naively and perhaps from a utopia perspective, that the very fast development of online education will provide opportunities for people if they want to grasp them. So that would be my advice to you, is focus on education, particularly on skills that you believe to be important for the future. And London, and I agree with you, Mark, that in many ways, London is a marvellous place, and it's marvellous in part because it holds one of the greatest creative clusters that the world has ever produced.
Okay, thanks, Linda. I do feel London schools are getting a bit of an unfair write-up here, given they are the fastest improving schools in the country, and London is the best place to go to school if you're poor. So I think there is something to celebrate about the London comprehensive education system. Pfizer, what are your policy solutions to address inequality then, coming from class, your think tank? And also, what do you do if the political support to pursue them just doesn't exist?
Yeah, so I think, just a couple of things I want to just pick up on as well in terms of this relationship between poverty and inequality and whether we should just be focusing on poverty. I think, yes, of course, it's great that London schools have got a lot better. Of course, there's a lot to be learned from that in a positive way. There's also more parents sending their kids to private school now. And so when you have only a certain number of positions, places at Oxbridge in these top positions, if it's still a certain group of people that are afforded certain luxuries and opportunities, then it still will be hard for people from lower income backgrounds to get there if that's sewn up at the top. And I think for me, of course we have to address poverty. It's not saying that we should only address inequality, but we can't do one without the other in a way. We have to look at what's happening at the top as well. And for me, the reason to address poverty and inequality together is that poverty is reduced faster when you reduce it, when you reduce inequality at the same time. When you think about inequality, you think about some of the structural causes that underline poverty. You don't just do, which is, you know, not a bad thing to do some of the cash transfers, but you also think about what's going on in the labour market. You also think about what's happening in the financial sector and who banks are lending to and who they're not lending to.
But there is a really important question, isn't there, which is how do you shift the structure of the jobs market? And I mean, I've not seen any good answers to that.
Look, one of the things that has to happen is, and there's things that's already happened. I think the Living Wage campaign has been really positive for what's going on at the bottom. We have to have an industrial policy. When you look at Germany, when you look at some of these countries that are doing better than us in this way, they've got green policies in place. It's not rocket science. It's having British investment banks invest in these long-term investments so that we rebuild some of those skills, right? Not everyone wants to go to university. Other people have other skills. So what can we do there to invest in our future? The market fails sometimes. We've noticed that, I think. And so this is somewhere where they're failing to invest in our green infrastructure going forward. What can we do in an industrial strategy? What can we do to rebalance the economy? And other countries do well on this, and it does create jobs. We have to make sure that we are paying those people at the bottom enough, and where those are effectively public sector jobs, like caring for our parents and our grandparents and our children, that those are decent wages. But we've got to intrinsically do something about the power imbalance. People forget that one of the drivers of inequality is deunionization. Now, we might have problems with unions or what have you, but the problem now is that we don't have a power balance between the owners and the employees. And that's why you don't get this kind of bartering up, making sure that people are getting paid enough. So to young people, I would say, get together, people power, vote, organise, join trade unions or other ways in which you can ensure a more collective voice, because there has to be that rebalancing in power. That has to be a pillar for change.
Okay. Mark, what do you think this line... Thanks. Mark, what do you think of this idea of a sort of a stakeholder economy? Do you think there's anything in it?
Yeah, I mean, it's always interesting, the criticism of short-termism of for-profit companies. And I think there is some interesting theoretical economic stuff around principal agent problems among shareholders. I mean, if each of us own one share in a company, why would any of us turn up to the AGM in order to try and improve that company? Why would I spend all of my time doing that when I'm only going to be one beneficiary of it and you would all take the benefit as well? So there are some problems with the principal agent problem. But my worry about sort of we need to take a long-term stakeholder economy view is it sounds very nice, but if anything, politicians and governments are even more short-term in their decision-making horizons. You only need to look at the long-run state of the British pension system, for example, to recognise that. The present government has made a few tweaks and changes that actually I think are designed to feel quite nice for pensioners today, but are storing up a demographic time bomb for 30 years' time. But why would they care? George Osborne and David Cameron are not going to be Chancellor and Prime Minister in 30 years' time. So I worry sometimes that it's what Hayek calls the fatal conceit, that just because you get problems in the market, you can't assume that they can be resolved by politics. In fact, politics can often make them worse. I should say I get very nervous about arguments which are a bit like the stakeholder economy, to rebalance the economy. Again, it all sounds very nice on the surface of it, but it tends to mean when you dig down into it, when you're rebalancing basically away from things you're good at and onto things you're bad at, is not actually a sensible economic strategy. So if it so happens to be the case that we are, for sake of argument, very good at financial services and insurance, but very bad at making widgets, that is not a reason to have an industrial policy to encourage widget making in the United Kingdom. That would not be a productive use of time, effort or labour. And just on the... But we're not anymore. We're not anymore. I mean, the...
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Right, okay. Well, there is at least one person in the audience who believes that the bright, brave UK future should be based around an industrial policy of widget making. I'm not so sure. In terms of what young people can do, I completely agree on the need for education. That won't necessarily solve inequality, by the way, but it will help make you personally rich if you're able to properly educate yourself, and that's a perfectly noble sentiment. And in terms of access, worth bearing in mind, I think I'm right in saying, when my parents, who are now just late 60s, early 70s, when they went to university back in the day, in the 60s, I think about 2% of people went to university, and it's now near as damn at 50%, maybe a shade less than that. I mean, that is a colossal spread of opportunity. So, all right, maybe people want it to be 100%. But in terms of access that young people have today to higher education is more than my parents could have dreamt of. I mean, they were very lucky to just make that cut, but my parents' generation couldn't have dreamed of the spread of opportunities that young people today have.
Okay, thanks, Mark. So we've got time for just one more round of questions, I think, and I'll ask the panellists to keep questions brief. Back. Lady in the middle over there.
I think there's sort of two different debates going on here. We're talking about education and opportunities of education and opportunities of getting rich. And actually, I think one of the big issues we're facing here is people who have very important jobs, like caring for people, teachers, the sort of jobs that actually keep a society together, can't actually live in a house or a home, many of them, for more than 6 months without being kicked out because the landlord wants to increase the rent. We have a massive problem with housing, and actually a society that pays jobs connected with wealth and money considerably higher than jobs that actually at the end of the day we all think are probably the most important. So I just wondered if the panel could address
Thank
that
you.
Issue.
Gentlemen at the very back there.
Good evening. My name is Kevin Spellman, and first of all I'd like to just thank the panel. All the ideas are definitely worth having come here for. The question that I have is basically on the definition of economics, and it doesn't seem as though we've given ourselves the latitude to redefine that. And the reason why I bring that up is because there's an economy of scale, there's the economy of the environment, there's a digital economy, and within each of those, there's a level of exclusion. So I just want to know, given an opportunity, would it be worth rethinking economy in order to define it in a way such that digital exclusion, environmental, and even school, some of these things that in theory that either we do or that we have seem to be askewed.
Right, thanks.
Good evening. I just wanted to ask the panelists about the fact that we, and I don't think it's really been touched on, the fact that London is a global city. London's competitors are not just the rest of the UK. London competes with cities from across the world, and this is a fact that we can't ignore, because when we talk about these issues of inequality, the issue isn't that, you know, it's not about people in London or banks or service sector earning lots of money in relation to people in the UK. It's a global phenomenon, and so you can't take London out of that. And so if the choice is, well, we could have less inequality by, I don't know, forcing banks to go abroad or doing all sorts of other things. Fine, you could do that, and that would be maybe legitimate if people wanted it. But then,
I don't think anyone's proposed that, though.
No, but what I mean is our position vis-a-vis other countries would be poorer, and is that something that we want to do, draw up the bridge
all
on
right,
our position with other countries?
I'm going to take a couple more questions, actually, because this is the last round.
Hi, my name is Katie Theobald. Before my question, I feel compelled to point out that although access to university has increased, actually the returns to university have fallen, and access to the most selective universities is actually worse, so it's not an even playing field. In terms of my question, though, we can talk a lot about general policies, but I think we know this is a long-standing problem, and I'd be very interested to know what everyone would say would be the one thing that we could do tomorrow and actually see a change.
You took the question right out of my mouth, thank you. And then there was one final question, gentleman in the blue tie over there.
The preface to the question is that we're talking a lot about averages, but actually the extremes of the measures from the top to the bottom are clearly getting wider. So my question is, where is the equality of opportunity?
Great. I'm going to ask panellists to keep questions answers really short because we're in danger of running over, but I want all of you to address that. What's the one thing you would do to address inequality question? Mark, going to start with you this time. Do you agree with the lady who asked the question that London's housing market is dysfunctional?
Completely dysfunctional. It's insane. I mean, it is not unusual for a household to be spending a third or a half of their disposable income on keeping a roof over their head. This is absolutely nuts. And actually, the pinch points that we see in other parts of the economy, such as, say, food banks, I don't think that's so much a reflection that food is colossally expensive. It's because rent is so colossally expensive that you've hardly got the money left to heat your home. And obviously, basically, the first thing people will do is put a roof over their head. The second thing they'll do is try and, you know, feed themselves and eat it. And if you make the, if you allow a position to prevail in which housing is this expensive, you are causing poverty problems because of that pinch on house prices and rents.
So what would you do about it?
I would abolish the Greenbelt tomorrow. If you are serious about tackling house prices, the problem is a lack of supply. That is the problem. Supply has grounded to a halt. And I know when everybody says, oh, build on the Greenbelt, people immediately sort of think of sort of beautiful chocolate box villages from some sort of Agatha Christie novel. But actually, most of the Greenbelt is pretty fallow and useless land. In the United Kingdom at the moment, that everybody tells me is an overcrowded island, we have only actually developed 10% of land in the UK, and only 5% of land is under concrete in the UK. If you were willing to see that dial up to, say, 7%, 8%, you know, you don't need to be bulldozing Stonehenge or whatever, or Sherwood Forest, or if you were willing to see that go up 7 or 8%, you would have sanity in property prices. And I think the international comparisons here are so important, because roughly a fair way of measuring the sort of cost of living is how many times the median salary do you need in order to buy an average property in that area. And as we've said, it's about 11 in London. I mean, in most other European countries, it's 4 or 5. In most areas of America, it's 3. If we could start to get the ratio between average earnings and property prices to somewhere around 4 or 5, I'm not saying every other problem goes away, but my God, they're mitigated.
Thank you, Mark. Pfizer, what's the one thing you'd do?
Just to say, I guess, if you're serious about doing something about the housing market, you would also do something about this global elite that is causing an escalator effect in our housing market. They're buying those very rich properties, and it's pushing up prices elsewhere. And No, the one thing I would say is that we need to start measuring success in different ways. Look, if we have this very narrow idea of success measured by GDP, we can talk about growth. I mean, I made the point in my speech. It just doesn't really capture what we really care about and a truly successful, efficient, happy place to live in.
Linda, what's one thing you do?
I want to carry on thinking about London as the creative cluster of the world. And to do that, we need to encourage entrepreneurship. I would do that by changing fiscal policy so that entrepreneurs in London were encouraged. And I'd do that by role modelling for young people so they thought that building a business, becoming an independent producer, being part of this incredibly vibrant economy would be something that they would really love to do.
And Danny, what's the one thing you do?
Okay, we should look at other global cities. We should ask why Tokyo can have some of the lowest income inequalities in the world and the highest life expectancy, or why New York can control
sushi.
Its rent and we can't.
you
did that. The Japanese had one of the lowest life expectancies in the 30s, but had the same diet.
So we know it's not sushi.
We have the people who study inequality. We've gone over all of these things. One thing I'd do is two things: abolish assured, because if you're the worst in the world, there's a lot to do. Abolish short-hold tenancies and make them 5 years. That can be done by a new parliament without retrospective legislation because they only last for a year. Five-year tenancies to stop people, the teachers, being kicked out so they can actually start a home and regulate the rents. And the second thing is what Thomas Piketty recommends, which is higher marginal tax rates, not to raise money, but to deter those thousands of bankers from taking that ridiculous amount of money. A higher rate when you're earning 200,000, a higher rate on 300,000, to control the greed of the very greedy. This is what Germany and other countries do. We were most creative when we had the highest marginal tax rates. That's when the Beatles wrote songs complaining about them and the Rolling Stones. You could debate with me if you're younger about how our music is so much better now we tax so much lower. But we have been creative. And if you want to look at creativity, the highest number of patents per head is Japan. The highest number of scientific papers per head is Scandinavia. The French are 20% more productive than we are. We have to look geographically at the rest of the world and recognise that something has gone very wrong here.
Okay. Thank you, Danny. Great. Well, all that remains for me to say before I hand over to Jeff Hayes, who's the chair of Trust for London, for some closing remarks, is to say a huge thank you to the RSA for hosting us. Thank you to our wonderful panel for their contributions and ideas. And most of all, thank you to all of you for coming along this evening. But now over to Jeff.
What a great debate. I suspect, had we given the panel 3 hours, we would still be having a good conversation about it. But I think it is. Sonia's already said a few thank yous, but on behalf of the Trust for London, I wanted to say a huge thank you to our esteemed panellists for such an interesting, thought-provoking and engrossing debate. It is a topic that is getting a lot of airtime, inequality in London, and continues to receive ever-increasing publicity and debate across all stakeholders. And I guess we've just proved that by this evening, by having the debate ourselves. So thank you, Danny, Faiza, Mark, and Linda. I think I ought to say thank you to Sonia as well. I think she did a wonderful job marshalling and convening the debate. Not an easy job, but I think you did it fantastically well and on time. So well done. Now, we're fortunate that Sonia is one of our trustees, as she mentioned at the outset. And I'm sure some of the debate that has gone on tonight will certainly be picked up by Sonia and the trustees at the Trust for London and discussed actively as we go forward from here. I think also we're in a magnificent room here, in a magnificent building, so I do want to thank the RSA for allowing us to host it here tonight, and to Alex Lucas and her team for the amount of work they put together to put this event on. It's been a great collaboration, and I'm really hoping that this will prove positive and will allow us and the RSA to have further events in the future. But I also want to thank two individuals from the Trust for London personally, because they have worked their socks off to put this event on with the RSA, and that's Marcus Langley and Nav Rai. Thank you, Nav. You did a great job. Thank you. And last but certainly not least, I really want to thank all of you tonight. I know all of you have busy diaries, lots to do, and the attendance we had tonight, and we did have an oath subscription, is a demonstration just how important this topic is. So thank you very much for participating tonight, certainly in the question and answers. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.